Hello, it's Thursday, June the 22nd. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show, and it's coming, as ever, from the Daily Mail newsroom. And it's a very special show because it's the 500th episode of The Andrew Pearce Show. The press, the free press, how free is it as the government considers a law which could lead to journalists being prosecuted and receiving jail sentences for up to 14 years for, frankly, doing their job? And we're talking about Hamlet, Ian McKellen making a triumphant return to the stage as Hamlet at the Theatre Royal in Windsor, aged 82, his mother is 20 years his junior. More chaos over our borders policy. Will France now be exempted from these new quarantine restrictions? Or is it true Spain and Greece could be added along with France? But first, the pingdemic. Supermarket shelves are starting to empty. And that's before we get any panic buying. And it's all because of the NHS app and the wretched pingdemic. The pingdemic is leaving supermarket shelves empty as deliveries start grinding to a halt. 1.7 million workers have been told to self-isolate after being pinged by the NHS COVID app. Drivers are also facing difficulties due to shortages related to Brexit. Joining me today is Rob McKenzie. He's the Managing Director for Policy and Public Affairs at the Road Haulage Association. Rod, we've talked before about the problems caused by Brexit and a shortage of HGV drivers and problems getting food and stuff into Northern Ireland. But the pingdemic is really causing a huge problem now.
Well, that's right, Andrew. It's sort of gone from very bad to much, much worse. And here's why. Just to catch new listeners up, we're short of about 100,000 lorry drivers in the UK. That's made up of a long-standing shortage of 60,000. Add to that 20,000 European drivers who had to go because of the change to immigration rules, and then add 30,000 trucker tests, which would normally have been done to get new drivers behind the wheel, but which couldn't take place because of pandemic restrictions. So that's a pretty bad place to start with. And then add to that, and there were shortages before of drivers and therefore delays to deliveries. And what's happened in the last fortnight is the pingdemic has really bit into that. So even those drivers who are available, some of them are now being told to isolate. And of course, that means they can't work, they can't deliver. And that's a pity. And it flies in the face of the science about lorry drivers as well.
You're arguing and have been for some time that the government has to make exceptions to people who have to isolate at home. They're talking about potentially supermarket workers. But your point very clearly is lorry drivers have to be included in the exemption.
Well, my logic is simply this. During the start of the pandemic, lorry drivers were classified as essential workers, without whom we wouldn't have been able to get food or medicine or, latterly, vaccines. So they are absolutely essential. But now, according to this latest announcement by the Prime Minister, only a very limited number of essential workers will be allowed to avoid isolation. Now, what does that mean? Lorry drivers simply don't know if that means them or not them. And the mechanism for finding out if it does is so opaque, no one can work out, you know, how you can get those permissions. But the facts are pretty plain. Lorry drivers in the first wave of infection accounted for 1% of infections in terms of their total number. So they weren't likely to be infected with COVID because they're lone workers and they spend very little time in contact with other people, for example, at delivery centres. So it doesn't make a lot of sense to isolate them and therefore cut off our nose to spite our face in terms of having deliveries to supermarkets and other places. So we're saying, look, if they're double jabbed and they test negative, let them work.
Now, we know there have been all sorts of problems in Tesco, Sainsbury's, Morrison's, Lidl, other chains as well. With your drivers, is there a risk, Rod, that because they've been coming often from a very long way away across the continent, that they may have been exposed to infection? Because they can't be secure in that cabin for the whole time, can they?
That's right. But actually, there are very few, comparatively few European lorry drivers coming here now for various reasons. But just to try and talk listeners through the procedure, when they arrive at a distribution centre, let's say they're bringing oranges from Spain in a lorry, they arrive at a supermarket distribution centre. They park in the right slot, and then other people come along, either mechanically or physically, and remove the load. They sign a chit, go to the loo, and then they're on their way again. So, you know, the contact is very minimal. And if we're saying that 15 minutes is a sort of dangerous time, most of this contact happens in the open air as well, where we know there is less risk, because most delivery centers are open air. And therefore, again, there just isn't a very good scientific reason for doing this to lorry drivers when we depend on them so much to deliver the things we need. Because without lorries, we get nothing in Britain.
And what happens also to some of the food that they're delivering, Rod, that's got a sell-by date on it? Is some food now going to waste?
Well, one of the disturbing stories that I've heard in the last few days is a farmer in the West Country who grows fruit. And he, at this time of year, he normally gets 5 lorries a week, one on each day, to pick up his fruit and take it to market or distribution centres run by the supermarkets, etc., etc. And he's only able to get 1 lorry a week. Now, that means that his fruit is sitting in his own storage with the clock ticking and not being delivered as fresh as it should be. So there's an illustration there of, you know, it really is from farm to fork, this stuff, when it comes to lorries. And we really do need to think about that all-important supply chain and distribution network on which we all depend.
Yeah, and of course the other thing's going to be, Rod, with the pingdemic, if and when petrol stations start to close down. Remember that happened before, 20-odd years ago when Tony Blair was Prime Minister? That would be a real problem again, because imagine your lorries would be affected by that too.
Well, that's right. We're seeing today, aren't we, that BP have closed some of their garages because they're not able to get tanker drivers, because some of the tanker drivers are, you know, pinged or whatever. So there is a real problem. As I say, everything we have in Britain comes on the back of a lorry at some point. And that's something that we all tend to forget, because it's often the little van that delivers our stuff or we go to the supermarket. But actually, that stuff has been on a lorry. And if you take the lorries out of the equation, we've got a real problem distributing everything that we get in Britain.
What we've also got to avoid, Rod, is the images of emptying shelves. It might encourage people to panic buy, which would just make it even worse. We saw that at the start of the first lockdown, didn't we?
Well, what I would say is there's no food shortage and there's no reason to panic buy. The problem is that the supermarkets are not able to deliver their usual amount of lorries in a day. So, for example, my local supermarket has a regular delivery every morning, which is great. No problems, and the shelves are fully stocked. But they're not able to get their second or third delivery because of the lorry driver shortage. And that means when you go in the evening, there's less stuff on the shelves because they're not able to replenish. Now, you know, that's just one supermarket as an example. It's not typical of everywhere. Everything is local and everyone's got a different issue or a different problem or maybe no problems at all. But certainly people shouldn't panic buy. But what is a problem is this declining number of active lorry drivers on top of an existing problem and therefore, a real headache for distribution. But the supply chain and the supermarkets are brilliant at this stuff. They make it work and they get stuff to us, but they are under severe pressure at the moment.
They certainly are. That's Rod McKenzie. He's Managing Director for Policy and Public Affairs at the Road Haulage Association. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces and more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at mailplus or me at ToryBoyPierce. Visitors to France are being instructed to quarantine on return to the UK, even if they're double jabbed. The government is saying it's because of the beta variant of COVID-19, but figures show that France has substantially fewer cases than both Spain and Greece, both of which are on the amber list, but have no restrictions. Experts are now calling for people with 2 vaccines to be exempt. Joining me now to try to make sense of the nonsense is the aviation analyst, Alex Macheras. Alex, I know somebody very close to me who rather rashly booked a trip to France last week, having been assured by somebody senior in government, absolutely no chance of France suffering any additional restrictions. 2 days later, It's now called Amber Plus, a completely new category, and people have to quarantine for 10 days when they get back, plus take all these tests. They're furious in France about it. People who want to go to France on holiday are furious too. Can you make any sense of it?
You know, I can't, Andrew, to be honest. And I can begin to try and sift through where we are now. But what I would really like is for the government to be doing that. And they haven't done that. You know, we have a transport secretary, Grant Shapps, who is heading up this travel policy. Do you know that since France has been introduced into what is the creation of this new category, quote, yeah, Amber Plus. Do you know, yeah, since that happened, we have not heard a word from the UK's Transport Secretary about this. He has not spoken publicly or tweeted once to even acknowledge the creation of this new category. Where is the clarity and the consistency for people, the industry, business, aviation, travel? It doesn't exist. It's non-existent.
Yeah, it's not just where is the clarity, where is the Secretary of State for Transport? We'll ask him. It's a very good point. And I was reading through these figures, as we do, to do our job properly, Alex, and I think the percentage of beta variant in France was about 3.2% and falling fast. Spain and Greece, 9 and 13%. The variant that's causing the big problem in France at the moment, of course, is the Delta variant, which has been rampaging through the UK for a very long time. So no difference there.
Well, this is what happens when we have government ministers creating travel policies that are ultimately shrouded in mystery. And you know, it's even worse than you just suggested, and I'll tell you why. The beta variant that they are citing as the reason for this new policy, France are acknowledging that there has been a recent increase in those beta variant cases, and they are registered for France as a whole. But when you break it down and look at exactly where they are on the French island territory of Reunion Island. That's just off the east coast of Madagascar. And Reunion Island is not on the same restriction, it's not facing the same Amber Plus restrictions as what mainland France is. This is why the aviation sector, scientists, the public are taking issue with these last minute decisions that do nothing but cause chaos and simply make no sense. And I've tried to make sense of this. I've spoken to scientists to say, help me understand why this decision was taken. And they said to me, well, Alex, if it was based on Reunion Island, we'd kind of get it, but we don't understand why it's based on France alone.
And just to put it in layman's terms, Madagascar, that particular island, is 6,000 miles from the French mainland. And there is a suggestion that the number crunches at the Department of Transport have conflated them all. But as you point out, they don't have the additional restrictions in Reunion Island. There has been talk, Alex, that the government may think again about France. But equally now, there's also talk that Spain and Greece could go on Amber Plus too. Now, what's your understanding of why that might happen?
Well, of course, because when you have France categorised in this way with the creation of a new category, one that has not even been recognised yet by our own Secretary of State for Transport, then scientists naturally have started to look at the data and speak to airlines and say, well, Spain looks like it's in a worse position. They've said there are a more variety of variants. They have higher case rates. Their cases are increasing faster. So just by trying to apply some kind of logic to this, which of course has no logic, but they're trying, they're basing it upon what has happened. And they're saying, well, by this logic, Spain and France potentially should be in the same category, maybe even Greece. And again, by not even having our Secretary of State for Transport come forward and explain the creation of this, I think we're going to see more uncertainty. I have spoken to a variety of different people who have already cancelled trips to Spain and Greece because they simply don't want to be caught up in the chaos that they describe is this summer.
And I think I'm right, Alex, just finally, France, Spain and Greece are the three most popular tourist destinations for British holidaymakers.
Exactly. This is, you know, these are our close allies in terms of friends, families and destinations for where people are holidaying. Not to forget the existing measures that are already in place. Not only is the overwhelming majority of the adult population double vaccinated, but British travellers are spending £11 million per week on the mandatory tests that are required when you are here in the UK. That's excluding the tests that you need to take from before. So there are these measures in place, which makes it even more peculiar as to why these sudden, almost politically driven last minute decisions are implemented, citing variants that are actually 6,000 miles away, closer to South Africa than they are in mainland France.
Fascinating. That is Alex Macheras, who is the aviation analyst. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with our other podcasts and our video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. So the government is proposing sweeping reforms to the Official Secrets Act. It could lead to journalists being prosecuted and receiving a 14-year prison sentence simply for doing their job. Some have suggested that publishing leaked footage, such as the video that brought down the former Health Secretary Matt Hancock, who was driving a coach and horses through the social distancing regulations, could now see journalists jailed. I'm joined now by Mick Hume, who's the author of There Is No Such Thing as a Free Press, and he's also editor-at-large of Spite. Mick, if this was happening in North Korea, I wouldn't bat an eyelid. It's happening in the United Kingdom.
Well, exactly, Andrew. Yes, we're in serious danger of joining that unsavoury club of nations who look upon journalism, journalists as spies and enemies of the state, if these proposals, which are at the moment only proposals, but if they are made into law. It's about criminalising investigative journalism, making it easier to prosecute whistleblowers and reporters, and imposing harsh new punishments on those found guilty. Because the government, the Home Office, has decided in its wisdom that whistleblowers and investigative journalists can be as big a problem as spies, and so investigative journalism should essentially be treated the same way as espionage.
Spies, or people who turn against their country and spy for other countries, they're traitors, treachery. How are they equating a journalist breaking a good story, which is exposing some form of wrongdoing or inappropriate behaviour in government? Or how can they put that on the same level?
Well, exactly. What we have to insist upon is that investigative journalism has nothing to do with espionage. It's about revealing hidden truths and embarrassing truths to the British people, not passing secrets to foreign powers. Well, what they want to do, Andrew, is to... there's various stages of this proposal. One of the key things is they want to remove the need for the state to prove that major damage to national security has been done by any disclosure. They can just assert it with a subjective, as they call it, judgment. And that's open to tremendous abuse, but and could leave those in power to want to cover up any embarrassing truth, exactly like the Matt Hancock, the images of Matt Hancock canoodling with his advisor in flagrant disregard for the rules that he'd imposed on the rest of us. So that will make it much easier to prosecute. And they also are resistant to the idea of, this is a key thing, I think, of a public interest defence. The idea that as a journalist or whistleblower, you could go into court and say, I did this, I know it's on the edge of the law, but I believe that it was in the public interest. That's a defence which any journalist must be able to rely on if you're going to have any chance of reporting the truth. And the Home Office says they don't want to consider a public interest defence because, as they put it in classic Home Office speak, it wouldn't be in the public interest. In other words, we've got the public interest being decided by state officials behind closed doors rather than by the public after an open reporting of the facts and a discussion of the truth.
Do you suspect the embarrassment in government over Hancock is a factor in this? And I know for a fact that the Victoria Newton, the editor of The Sun, wrote, I think, in the New Statesman or The Spectator, that the video of Hancock's shenanigans in his private office with his advisor was the most watched video content they've ever had in the history of The Sun, which I think shows not just that the public is interested, but there is a public interest too.
Exactly. No, I think, obviously, this process, this consultation, which has now come to an end, has been going on for a while, long before the Hancock.
Yeah.
But it's undoubtedly added a much sharper edge to the authorities' wish to be able to control this kind of information. We only have to remember, Andrew, that it's only a week or so ago that they sent the data protection police down to raid people's houses in the south of England and confiscate computers in searching for those whistleblowers of the Hancock affair, and saying that those images could be an infringement of his data privacy. And you think, what on earth has it got to do with data privacy to have images of a government minister canoodling in a government office in flagrant breach of his own regulations? It's clearly they are prepared to use any tool of the warp of the law, basically, to control public information and to get stop embarrassing truths being put out there for the rest of us to understand.
I mean, if we were to cast our mind back to 2009, at that time I was on the Daily Telegraph, and that's when we broke the extraordinary story about the MPs' expenses scandal, which led to three MPs went to prison, a number of members of the House of Lords went to prison, and as a result of the revelations, the MPs' expenses became transparent and went online for the first time. I suspect that whole exercise would not have passed this current test.
Exactly, and there are new other new laws, like the bribery laws and so on, which have been brought in since then, which are also a major problem for investigative journalism. The point about investigative journalism, Andrew, as you know better than I, it always involves underhand methods, because you're trying to find the truth that somebody, and usually somebody in power, wants hidden. And it often means you're on the edge of the law. And that's why it's so important to be able to appeal and say, as in the MP's expenses scandal, this is so clearly in the public interest that exposing it is absolutely vital in a democratic and free society. And having laws that stop you doing that is, as you say, more at home, something more at home in North Korea or Erdogan's Turkey than it is in Britain in the 21st century.
And just finally on that, Mick, is it all the more surprising to you, it certainly is to me, that if this proposal does become a fact, that this will be happening under a government run by a journalist called Boris Johnson?
Well, exactly. I think... The Boris, I mean, sometimes you think, has there been some kind of invasion of the body snatchers? That Boris Johnson, the journalists of old, and Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, seem to be completely different people with completely different views on this is exactly the kind of thing that he would have been railing against in his columns for so many years. And now he's become the kind of front man for this illiberal control culture and cancel culture. And the Conservatives have made press freedom, apparently, a major plank of their foreign policy and set up a National Committee to defend journalists, yet at the same time, in the usual double standards, they're proposing a new law that could see more journalists being railroaded into jail and would have a much wider chilling effect on other journalists who are going to think twice, and whistleblowers are going to think twice and three times about revealing truths if they're going to get them into this kind of hot water.
Absolutely. That's Mick Hume. He's author of There Is No Such Thing as a Free Press, and he's also editor-at-large of Spiked. Thanks for joining us. So it's that point in the podcast. Hugo Duncan, Deputy Business Editor, is here. Well, Hugo, I don't know if you were listening to the Business Secretary, Kwasi Kwarteng, saying that he welcomed the fact that private equity companies were about to take over one of our much-loved supermarkets, Morrison's. He thought that was a positive sign of Great Britain PLC. I thought it sounded terrible.
Well, that's right, Andrew. The Business Secretary was talking this morning about the controversial takeover of Morrison's. Now, Fortress, which is a US private equity company, has agreed a deal with the Morrison's board to buy the company for £6.3 billion. But this has caused an enormous amount of concern over what their plans are for the company. Private equity has a checkered history, to say the least. It's owned companies like Debenhams that have gone into trouble following their ownership and so on. So there have been concerns about what it means for jobs, what it means for investment, what it means for the suppliers. You know, lots of, you know, farmers and so on around the country that supply Morrison's, and indeed what it means for consumers. But Kwasi Kwarteng said he would have a look into this deal, and he has had meetings with the Morrison's hierarchy, and indeed was speaking this morning about a meeting he had with Morrison's chairman, Andy Higginson, only this week. And he today gave the deal his almost sort of full-throated support. He did say, indeed, it was a vote of confidence in the UK. He said that the fact that these private equity companies wanted to come and buy really good assets in the UK was a good thing. He said, we're bringing in money, we're bringing in investment, and indeed, we may even be creating jobs, not something that private equity has always been credited for, given job losses that have often followed such takeovers.
I almost choked on my cup of tea, too, when he said, the management, I've talked to the board, they're really, really pleased about the deal. Of course they are. They're going to make millions out of it.
Well, this is right. I think something like the top three at the company stand to get shares and awards that they may have otherwise got worth about £35 million.
I think
combined.
I'd be happy with that, Hugo,
wouldn't
you?
Well, it certainly raises a question as to whether it's in the interests of the board and the company bosses, or and indeed some of the other shareholders who will of course be making who will of course be getting good returns on this, but I don't think that will allay the fears of perhaps even the staff and indeed others who are worried about what this would mean for, as you say, one of Britain's big four supermarkets, another one, Asda, of course, already in private equity hands.
Very worrying, I think. That's Hugo Duncan, Deputy Business Editor at the Daily Mail. So we've had colour and gender-blind casting in theatre, but what about a son who's older than his mother? Sir Ian McKellen, the legendary Ian McKellen, playing Hamlet at 82, performing opposite a woman 20 years his junior, playing his mother in the Theatre Royal's latest adaptation of Hamlet. Patrick Marmion, the Daily Mail's theatre critic, joins me now. Patrick, you gave that one hell of a glowing review.
It was worth it, I think. The old boy is definitely worth it. I mean, I don't know what I'm going to be doing at 82, but it will be certainly nothing that like as energetic as that, never mind as accomplished or anything of that order. You know, he's still got it, Ian McKellen. You know, he really, as I think I said in the review, he bestrides the stage like a colossus, to quote another one of Shakespeare's plays. But and he's really, you know, he's got stage presence in spades, obviously.
I love this expression too, jaunty of limb, yet antique of voice. There's a playfulness about his pensionable Dane. He's so versatile, isn't he? And of course, lots of people will, I hope they don't, but they may just think about him in X-Men and as Gandalf the Grey and Gandalf the White in Lord of the Rings. But he's always been a superb stage Shakespearean actor.
Well, you know what? He's a pro, is what he is. He's a total pro. And actually, I don't think that he would... he would set any less store by the work that he's done, in X-Men or in the Lord of the Rings. And he's terrific in both, and that he'll have done very well out of them. But he's someone who's never ever given up on the stage. And some people, they sort of go off, and the stage becomes a kind of a poor cousin, which they just drop in on and patronise. But he's absolutely been the core of his life, really, you know, from the get-go. And it's actually there, working with a company of actors, that you think you really see him at his best. And, you know, if you think you like Ian McKellen on screen, I can only advise you to go and see him on stage, because, you know, he works well off other people, and he's a real company man. I mean, that's a phrase, obviously, which means something quite different I mean, sometimes that might make be associated with being boring, but he's anything but, of course. And but he's got, one of the great things about him is he doesn't have airs and graces, although he's very able to put them on as the occasion demands.
Was it a risk for the theatre to cast him in that role?
Well, I think yes and no. I think the short answer really is no, because of course people are going to flock to see it. I mean, why wouldn't you want to? Even if it was for the vicarious pleasure of seeing him make a hash of it, which was, to be honest, was never really going to happen. But it was a risk. If it didn't work, I don't think he would have done it if he didn't believe that it would work, or indeed that he could carry it off. But I think that the risks, therefore, are more to do with the fact that he might get exhausted. I mean, you know, he does seem very fit and nimble, but nonetheless, he is still 82, and you don't know how much, doing 8 shows a week is pretty demanding. It's a long show,
too.
Yeah,
I was going to ask you about that.
And then, of course, there's the whole COVID thing, which he's exposed himself to. So, you know, I think the risks turn out to be more there than they are artistic, because everybody, you know, no one does Shakespeare now anymore, really, without messing with the bard very severely. People used to talk about doing Shakespeare straight. I don't think that anybody knows what that means anymore.
Yeah, and I mean, and as you say, 8 performances a week, and he's 82, and of course, some of those speeches, the soliloquies, you just say he delivers them in quite an extraordinary way, and with a new interpretation, even making him sadder, more resigned, which makes it even more melancholy.
That's right. Yeah. All of that is true, and it's as though he's as I also said, I think it's as though he's almost reliving his past in a sort of dream state. And because you don't sort of fall into some kind of trance and start to see a young man darting about the stage, you know, as Hamlet normally is. You do still see an old man. I mean, there's a great picture that goes with it of him next to a skull, and you realize how old he is, and you know, and how his next major appointment in life is with the Reaper, probably. And I don't mean that in a mean sort of way. I mean, the shape he's in, he's got another 20 years in him, at least, I would say. But it's he mines that. Hamlet is a character who's obsessed with death. As an older man, he's a little bit closer to it than he was. And I think that really does, it invests the part with a perspective that a younger Hamlet simply can never have. And actually, what's really amazing is that it works. It works. And it makes you see the play afresh. And I think that is always what all directors and actors really want for, in terms of, you know, taking on a new new production of an old play, is to find something new in it. And, you know, if that was their aim, you know, they've really struck oil, I think.
Why did Stephen Berkoff pull out? Do you know the inside story?
I don't have the inside story, but Stephen Berkoff is not a man to hold back. And so I imagine that he was quite outspoken in the company, and I imagine that you know, he doesn't mind rubbing people up the wrong way. I don't know whether he did or not. I don't know, but it's entirely, shall we say, plausible. And officially, and I think I suppose we're obliged to raise our eyebrows, but believe that he pulled out because the show was extended, and then he had commitments that clashed with that.
And replaced by the lead by one of the theatre's leading ladies, Frances Barber.
Honest,
isn't that the joy of Shakespeare?
Yeah, well, exactly. To be honest with you, I've been a huge admirer, actually, of Stephen Berkoff, and in particular his writings back in the day. He was very big in the 80s, doing kind of satirical cod Shakespearean dramas, which are really terrific fun. As an actor, he divides audiences, shall we say. But I think that Frances Barber is just fabulous, and she will always unite an audience, because she's just got a bit like McKellen in some ways, but in her own particular way. She's got a huge stage presence, and she's a big Rolls Royce of an actor. I don't mean physically big, by the way. The girl's got style, you know, and to burn. And so she steps into that role. And I was kind of thinking, oh, God, is she gonna play it big in a kind of Berkoff sort of way? And actually, she doesn't. She's really lovely and balanced, you know, because he's a character, Polonius, who's a kind of wittering courtier who's very easy to send up. And she doesn't do that, actually. She really keeps faith with that. And when other people try to send him up, her character, she sort of looks a little bit disappointed in them.
Very interesting.
And she really carries it well. So, I mean, to me, I thought that was a great revelation there as well. And I think that they may have been unlucky to lose lose Berkoff, but they were extraordinarily lucky to gain Frances Barber, who's a wonderful actor, and I think actually an old friend of Ian McKellen. So she just slotted straight in, really.
Not so keen, though, on Hamlet's mother, not just because she was 20 years younger, but you didn't think Janie Seagrove quite cut it? You weren't so keen on the accent? What was
no,
that about?
I think she's good. What she's doing is something quite interesting. She's doing something very tense. She's trying to hold herself together, and she's trying to pretend somehow that this isn't happening, to try to marry the divide that exists between the fact that she has betrayed her son, or maybe betrayed her son, which is something she can't believe, and that maybe her now husband is guilty of murdering her previous husband. So in a way, it's an act of repression to try and deny that, and she's got a kind of steeliness. But to that, she doesn't. I think it's a German accent, and I was a bit puzzled by that. I couldn't see why she was doing it. Didn't seem necessary. So I would like to, I suppose, for her to have dropped that, so that we didn't have that distraction. We could have just concentrated on her trying to kind of reconcile these warring parts of her psyche.
Fascinating. That is Patrick Marmion, the Daily Mail's theatre critic, on Sir Ian McKellen's Hamlet at Windsor's Theatre Royal. Thanks for joining us. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.